from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, as the BART strike enters its third day, we'll discuss strikes and the tactics of organized labor. Union participation is dwindling, and strikes have become increasingly uncommon in recent years as workers fear putting their jobs in jeopardy during a bad economy. As the economy begins to improve, will workers head to the picket line to protest conditions they may have tolerated in leaner times? And are labor tactics that brought change in the 1930s still effective now? Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In this opening hour, we want to discuss issues related to labor and unions, since, as we've seen, an uptick in the economy has led to a desire for better wages among workers, which in turn brought on strikes like the one of the BART workers' two unions. And the question is, how much have unions declined, and to what extent has the strike as a tactic declined? And can unions reinvent themselves, and how effective is organized labor apt to be? Those really are the questions that we want to take up in this opening hour. First, just to give you a quick update on the BART strike in its third day, with all of the frustration, the long waits, and certainly the horrible traffic congestion. Nevertheless, there is some hope on the horizon. They are going to be meeting today at 3 o'clock, and there are a couple of mediators who are meeting with them. So they are talking again, at 1 o'clock this afternoon. They're talking again, and the fact of the matter is that there are still big gaps, but mediation is involved, and so there's some hope. And there was also an agreement reached with one of the smaller striking unions representing a couple of hundred supervisors and professional workers with BART management. So we will obviously keep you informed and up to date as we move along through the day. In the meantime, let me introduce the guests who are with us for this opening hour. Harley Shaken is with us, professor of geography and director of the Center for Latin American Studies. He specializes in labor issues and is a professor at UC Berkeley. And welcome back to Forum, Harley Shaken.
Very nice to be here.
Good to have you here. And good to also have Phil Wilson, who is new to Forum, but a labor lawyer and president of the Labor Relations Institute, a management-side labor relations consulting firm. He's with us this morning. I like the sound of this, from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, which is actually near Tulsa. Welcome, Phil Wilson.
Thank you. Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you here with us. And let me begin, Harley Shaken, with you. And we're talking about really what may be somewhat of a change in terms of labor unions. And we'll talk about later on what Trumka has to say and others in the labor union movement. But the recession and globalization certainly saw a decline in the strike as a tactic, people afraid of their job loss and temporary workforce and replacement workers. Now we're seeing a kind of more, I suppose, militant rhetoric and a desire at least for maybe bringing the strike back, aren't we?
Well, we're seeing an unusual moment. We're in the midst of a modest, uncertain recovery, but that tends to give workers and unions in particular a bit of confidence to try to make up for ground lost. So we're seeing a bit of that. We're not seeing a major strike wave or even the resurgence of the strike as a labor weapon, although it remains very often the weapon of last resort. But we are clearly seeing workers concerned about getting a few gains when times, at least for right now, are a bit better.
Well, a strike would be a better weapon, presumably, in a better economy. And yet there's a kind of a generation gap here, isn't there, Professor Shaken? That is, young people are not really as aware of the strike as a tactic or for that matter, union history or union values.
Well, young people aren't as aware of unions per se. That is, people who grew up in the 50s viewed unions as a very powerful social movement. You might be for them, you might be against them, but they were a constant daily presence in your life. That's not the case today. In the 50s, about one out of three workers was a union member. Today, it's about 11%, a little over overall, and about 0.6% in the private sector. So the critical mass is much smaller today than it was several decades ago.
Well, Phil Wilson, the unions are trying to reinvent themselves, but there's been a failure to organize new workers, even though new workers are on the horizon, or for that matter, to grow the membership, though it has at least done better here in California. One could argue a loss of political power. Organized labor, according to a New York Times recent article, is in free fall. Would you agree with that?
There's a lot of evidence for that, although I think, we're seeing evidence, as Harley mentions, of the beginnings of resurgence, perhaps, but if you want to look at the glass half empty, there's plenty of evidence for that. From the number of union members is in a pretty steep decline, particularly in the private sector. I think as we move on to talk about BART, I think the public sector is an interesting place to look at union power. But certainly in the private sector, there's pretty much any way you measure it in terms of the number of members and even some of the faster growing unions like the SEIU, who's one of the unions involved in the BART strike, the Service Employees International Union. They were one of the faster growing unions. They have shrunk in last year's numbers. So they are certainly by a lot of measures on the decline. You can also, to your point on political power, the state of Michigan, is now a right-to-work state, which I think most people would, if you told them a year or two earlier that Michigan would be a right-to-work state, they would probably send you to a loony bin. But it's been a tough couple of years for traditional organized labor.
Well, you've said, and I think it's an important distinction for people to realize, that organized labor or unions seem to have at least more clout in the public sector than they do in the private sector, but the big battle in Wisconsin was kind of a turning point, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Wisconsin was interesting, and I don't know that we've sort of seen the end of the fallout there. So Scott Walker, I think, he was able to push through. He and the legislature there were able to push through some pretty significant reforms that certainly were opposed by the public sector unions. The unions then went after a recall movement to try to get rid of him. They failed to get rid of him. They did recall a couple of key senators, so there was at least a little bit of silver lining in those efforts, but the Wisconsin example was, and that was really sort of the first domino. There was Wisconsin. Indiana became a right-to-work state, which was also somewhat surprising. Then that followed with with Michigan becoming a right-to-work state. So those were big challenges. And then there were some big ballot initiatives in California last year around the same time that also failed, that were supported by unions. So again, if you think the glass is half empty, that's the kind of stuff you'd point to.
Well, and yet, Harley Shaken, it appears as if the unions are trying to reinvent themselves. I mentioned Richard Trumko, for example, who's head of AFL-CIO, president of AFL-CIO, calling for deep thought and new organizing innovations in the union movement. And in some ways, there seems to be at least a desire to bring in maybe more non-traditional workers to do things like strikes at places where perhaps those sort of activities didn't take place in the past. There is a kind of reinvention process going on, isn't there?
Oh, I think there certainly is. Everything Phil mentioned is true. These are very tough times for labor, but historically this has tended to bring out the best in the labor movement. 1936 was a very grim year in the midst of the Depression, yet the next year the contemporary labor movement was really born in the midst of a modest recovery. I'm not saying we're that close to a resurgence here, but we are seeing a sense within the labor movement that they are in crisis. And more broadly, we're seeing a number of very innovative tactics that are showing results. In the last week, for example, Unite Here, a union that represents workers in the hospitality industry and hotels, signed an agreement with the Hyatt Corporation. It was an important contract agreement for unionized workers, but far more important, Hyatt pledged to stay neutral in all the hotels it owns or operates for union organizing drives going forward. A second example of innovative strategies coming out of the AFL-CIO is Working America. This is a group that seeks to organize non-union workers who agree with labor's political principles. They've organized in the last several years about 3 million workers nationally in about a half dozen states. They plan to spread that to all 50 states. So there are signs of labor engaging what, by all accounts, are very, very tough, a very tough situation and very real obstacles that remain.
Nevertheless, last year the union movement lost 400,000 members, although it still has 14.5 million, so it's still a force to be sure. But interesting things on the horizon. For example, the number of Latino workers has increased, has it not, in union membership? Well,
Absolutely. Unions have embraced immigration, and they have really worked very hard across the country to engage the Latino community, the Asian American community, other immigrant communities as well. And this has shown very, very important results. Actually, last year, if you exclude California, the labor movement lost 500,000 workers. But in California, it gained 100,000 workers. And an important dimension of that was its outreach and engagement with Latino workers.
Again, Harley Shaken is professor of geography and director of the Center for Latin American Studies at UC Berkeley. And his specialization is labor issues. Phil Wilson is a labor lawyer and president of Labor Relations Institute, which is a management side labor relations consulting firm. And what about, Phil Wilson, the calculation of when to go on strike, how to use the strike as a tactic? Has that changed over the years?
I'd like to, if I could, just follow up quickly on something that Harley was just talking about, which I do think is important. You know, I've talked about the glass being half empty, but if you're looking at the glass half full, I do think not simply just their union's embracing of immigration, but their alignment with worker centers, doing a lot of the grassroots work, you know, watching what they're doing around the immigration issue is very smart on their part. Another area, and I'm sure Harley will have some thoughts about this as well, is the this alt-labor movement, which is a moniker that covers a lot of, you know, different things that unions are doing. So Working America is an example of that, but they are allying with a lot of different kind of non-traditional union groups and doing some very interesting things in terms of protests. The most recent, it's called a bunch of different things, but I think the best kind of tagline is Fight for 15, but they have engaged in sort of rolling strikes across the country in retail and fast food establishments, which are traditionally areas that unions have a very tough time organizing, and a lot of people argue that it's almost impossible for them to organize because it's low wage, it's high turnover, it's transient workforce that isn't really committed to one place for very long, and so it's kind of hard to make a campaign happen there. But they nevertheless have engaged in strike activity and been reasonably, and I would say surprisingly, successful at that activity. So just as an example, they've shut down several fast food locations. They've shut down several small retail locations in cities like Chicago and St. Louis and others. And the approach is very different than the traditional, than like the BART situation. You know, it's a fight over kind of an idea versus over a particular employer and over a particular set of contract demands, and it's engaging folks in multiple different locations around the issue. And I think it ties in nicely to some of the you know, the Occupy protests that happened a couple summers ago, and I think that they're kind of carrying on that activity. So if you're looking at the glass half full, you would point to things like what Harley mentioned and some of these alt-labor activities. I think an interesting question is, okay, well, what does that mean for the traditional labor movement, and you know, how do they, you know, at the end of the day, their businesses themselves. I mean, they have to make money at some point. But I think, you know, if you're looking for evidence of resurgence, that's it. And then your question was, how do they make the calculation of when to strike? And at the end of the day, you know, my take on strikes is pretty simple. It all comes down to leverage. You know, there's things you want. There's things that that the company wants. And if you can't get an agreement on it, then one of your weapons is to strike, and the calculation about when to do it is whether you feel like you have more leverage than the organization does, and that's exactly the calculation that occurred in the BART situation. It's the calculation that occurs in any strike.
Well, it's also certainly tactics in terms of strike with respect to timing and with respect to what kind of community support you have. And mm-hmm. hope we can have an opportunity to talk about those some. But we should make clear the fact, Phil Wilson, that you your business essentially is helping businesses. So we know that you are, for the most part, one who tries to see to it, at least, as a labor lawyer. And you're very fair-minded in your presentation of the picture of unions. But it takes a side of businesses, which prompts me just to ask you, since we saw kind of an ideological shift with President Reagan and with Maggie Thatcher, why don't more businesses take the idea, especially since we've got such high unemployment rates, that we're just going to fire people and hire new workers like Reagan did with the air traffic controllers?
Well, there's a lot of there's a lot of restrictions, our laws, and I think if you want to talk about. I like to say they put the fun in dysfunctional, but the National Labor Relations Board that we have, whatever you want to say about them, the law is clear, and I think it's absolutely correct. You can't discriminate against somebody because they're exercising their rights to organize, and so companies are prohibited from firing people for, you know, striking or for organizing activity. There's things that companies can do to respond to those activities, and I think the balance, the balance in the law is pretty good. I think the problem with the law as it stands now, and I think this hurts both workers and companies, is that justice is just not very swift. It takes the agency, you know, it's like glacial speed to resolve issues, and that hurts both employers and employees. So I think one thing that stops employers from doing that is simply it's illegal. I think even beyond that, even in fast food, even in retail, it's a highly competitive world that we live in now. And all the rhetoric aside, if you actually run a business, you can't just kind of plug in another person and away you go. You have to train people. You have to recruit them. And the people with the best talent at the end of the day win. And so just sort of having as your game plan that if somebody barks or complains about something, I'm going to fire them, it's not a very good strategy to be in business for a long time.
Of course, Harley Shaken, a lot of what we're talking about here is complicated now by just the whole question of sustainability. I mean, when you have questions of pensions and health care providing and so forth, as has come up in the BART strike, as a safety for that matter, it becomes a lot more complicated.
Oh, it surely does. These are very tough issues. There are no easy answers in any of these areas. And in a way, they're all related and reflect broader public policies. But I do think we have to put it in a larger context. And here we've seen, along with the decline of unions, this isn't some abstraction or a set of statistical figures. It's also meant that workers have less leverage in the economy, and the share of our gross domestic product, that is the value of everything we produce, to labor has gone down dramatically. In 2012, salaries accounted for 43.5% of the total GDP in this country. That was a record low since they've been keeping statistics in this area. In 1969, it was 53.5%. So the decline of union strength has resulted in stagnant wages and in a lot of economic problems that translate into one of the contributing factors very likely to the current weakness of the recovery. 70% of our economy is consumer spending. So if consumers have less to spend, the flip side of lower wages, then we're going to see some shaky economic results down the road.
Well, that's the most, in some ways, maybe really formidable challenge to labor leaders and to unions. I mean, when BART, for example, goes out on strike, people get angry. And we heard a lot of it on the air here the first day. Why are they asking for a wage increase when I can't get one and I haven't had one in years and all that sort of thing? There really is a kind of PR job of convincing the public that, let's say, the stake of higher wages is maybe linked. We're all in this together, that sort of thing. And the middle class and its role is perhaps at stake.
Oh, I think that's a critical challenge for unions. A moment ago, Phil mentioned that union strike and the key issue is one of leverage. I would agree with that, but today it's a bit more complicated because it isn't simply leverage across the bargaining table. Unions have realized that they must reach out and gain the support of a far broader public. And that's not incidental, particularly in a strike like BART. In the 1950s or 60s, when unions were a larger sector of the workforce, people assume, well, if the UAW wins a wage gain here, I'll be better off tomorrow because I'll be able to win it in my workplace. Today, many people view, well, if they have it and I don't mind if they lose it. And unions are seeking very hard to turn that perception around to say, if a gain is won for labor, say, in the BART situation, that is something that might translate more broadly into the rest of the economy.
Do you think this is also a generational gap? I mean, young people being more individual-minded and job security-minded and not thinking about group solidarity or anything along those lines?
Well, I think that's absolutely a part of it. But I would also point out another anomaly. We're in California, and California in so many ways leads culturally, economically, demographically for the rest of the country. In California, labor is 18% of the workforce, not 11%. And in California, we've seen labor growth, as I mentioned last year, by 100,000, while we've seen decline in the rest of the country by 500,000. So the situation is a bit different politically and in terms of broader perception in California. But the underlying issue that you mentioned about younger people and about the broader consciousness and awareness of labor is a very real challenge.
And I also want to mention, since we've been talking about the difference between private and public workers, that the majority of unionized workers actually work for the government. I'm going to give you an opportunity to join this discussion. In fact, not only give you an opportunity, a welcome and join you to join us. Your thoughts about organized labor and about the future of organized labor and about the strike and the use of a strike as a tactic and its efficacy, you can join us now. Our toll-free number is available, and we welcome your involvement in the program. Call us at 866-733-6786. Again, the number for your phone calls, toll-free, is 866-733-6786. Or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And, of course, you can also join us by tweeting us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum, or by going to our Facebook page. But do feel free, again, to join us. Talking with Phil Wilson, labor lawyer and president of Labor Relations Institute. He's with us this morning from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, which is near Tulsa, and he's on the management side of labor relations consulting. Harley Shaken, longtime labor advisor and labor veteran analyst and scholar, professor of geography and director for the Center for Latin American Studies at UC Berkeley, and an expert in labor issues. When we return, we'll bring you into the discussion. Please feel free to be involved. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're devoting this hour to the state of organized labor as the BART strike enters its third day, discussing strikes and tactics of organized labor. Union participation is dwindling nationally, though it's up here in California, but strikes have become increasingly uncommon in recent years as workers fear putting their jobs in jeopardy during a bad economy. And as the economy begins to improve, will workers head to the picket line to protest conditions they may have tolerated in leaner times? And are labor actions that brought change in the 30s still effective now? Wrestling and grappling with those questions, we're going to hear from you in a moment. Harley Shaken with us from UC Berkeley. Specialization is labor issues. And Phil Wilson, labor relations management side labor lawyer, is with us from Oklahoma. And before we bring our listeners in this, Phil Wilson, this is a kind of a broad question. I was reading about Columbus, where you had a lot of union activity and grassroots support for it and working class communities. And then there was a sense of, well, I guess what could best be characterized as disillusion, because all this building went on with community organizations, and then the community felt that the union didn't support them reciprocally in foreclosures and vacant housing and human trafficking, all kinds of issues that were brought up. I mean, from your perspective, is this where unions can maybe gain strength more in the community by being much more aware of what they need to do on behalf of the community, especially if they get grassroots working class behind them?
I think it's an interesting point. I mean, and you see, you know, as I was discussing with the alt labor groups as an example, you know, they are definitely, they've always been active in their communities, but I think there was a perception, and you see threads of this in the BART dispute around, you know, that they're out for themselves and that they, are greedy. And I think that they found that kind of partnering up with other groups, immigration is a great example. But you brought up human trafficking. There's a number of other issues like that that they are quite active in that don't have necessarily an immediate payoff for them. But at the same time, you know, are, I think what they feel like are the right things to do and align themselves with their communities. I think, you know, bigger picture, as you think about the slide of labor unions, and Harley brings up some interesting statistics, but I think that there's a fair argument whether, you know, correlation is the same thing as causation, and that, you know, as membership has declined, you know, are some of the reasons for that decline because workers have lost power, or is it just simply structural changes in the economy of the world that, you know, just are not going to change? And I think there is a big perception in the part of a lot of working people, and you mentioned younger workers. I think that's true, but even older workers that just don't see the value proposition for unions, even in companies where they have high density and they have there's a lot of members. They are watching those folks. They're not getting, you know, they don't get the rich contracts that they had, and new groups of organized employees don't get the rich contracts that people like BART employees enjoy. And that is, if you can't deliver on the promise, it's hard to justify forking over the money that you have to pay every month to get the representation. So I think they have a bigger issue, and Harley brings up the PR issue in campaigns, which is definitely part of the leverage in a strike. But it's a bigger issue for unions generally. Is that, if they lose the PR battle on what they can actually deliver for people, that hurts their ability to get people to sign up and pay them money.
Well, a lot of people get angry, and I'm talking, of course, about my experience here behind the microphone when they read or hear about the kind of salaries CEOs make. But there's been a lot of anger, about this BART strike. I'll give you an example here. On our forum website, a listener named Bill writes, "Think a lot of Bay Area residents, while appreciating wholeheartedly the great service that BART provides, have an extremely hard time feeling sorry for people who are making on average $83,000, I think that's high, but anyway, he says a year before overtime, and have guaranteed pensions for life, and yet that's not enough for them. There are few, if any, jobs in any industry that pay that well for a relatively low-skilled job." Getting a lot of those kind of responses, and we did certainly when the BART strike took off. Let me tell you some other responses here before I go to your phone calls. We asked on our Facebook page what must unions do to be more effective in bringing about substantial change? And just to give you a sampling of responses, Jody writes, for one thing, they might want to stop shouting about power as angry commuters walk by and instead speak about justice. Unions need to do more teaching and less preaching. Posted after taking the ferry at 6 a.m., which was lovely, but quite a huge pain. Wendy says unions in general need to work with non-unionized workers to help them get similar benefits and should have been doing this all along. Workers should have an option to have something like enhanced Social Security benefits, pay in more and get a better benefit at retirement. Unions need to teach the history of working people in this country and find common ground with all workers. And another listener writes, start paying into their pensions like regular unions. And let me go to our callers. And we begin with a caller from Oakland. Chris, you're on.
Good morning. Two comments. One, and you've touched on this, is the labor movement has largely become a public sector labor movement. When I was, I worked my way through law school and college as a Teamster Union brewer. And in those days, it was illegal for public employees to be unionized. So the labor movement was entirely a private sector movement. Nowadays, with it being largely a public sector movement, people perceive that they are paying for those union benefits. The second issue is something else you just touched on. We're still suffering from the hangover from the McCarthy era. Everywhere in the rest of the world, after World War II, the union movement got things like pensions and health care made a national benefit, so that everybody got it. Now it is unionized workers who have what everywhere else in the world is a national right. And yet we end up bargaining over that, and there's a whole bunch of people who don't have it, and I think it causes resentment.
I think you're right. I think we've been hearing that and reading it in the emails. In fact, Harley Shaken, I want to go to you on this. I want to dovetail the comments we just heard with a listener, Wade, who says, I'd like to see someone address the damage the BART union's position is doing to the cause of public sector unions generally. Most public workers do not enjoy the same kind of leverage to extort generous concessions. Public workers with less leverage, like public school teachers, will be the victims of the animosity these unions are generating. If the BART unions stood up for the safety of Muni and AC Transit workers too, instead of cynically implying they would trade their own safety for wage concessions, the impression would be much different. This strike is a gift to the Scott Walkers of the world and a step backward from real union solidarity.
Well, that's pretty harsh. I think it reflects some attitudes certainly that are out there, but I think it's really misstating the case of what's going on here. We've got to put the present dispute in, I think, a broader context. Over the last 5 years, when the system was really in crisis in terms of its finances, unions made some very significant concessions. These workers haven't had a pay raise in 5 years. Inflation has gone up considerably over that five-year period, meaning their real wages, that is, wages adjusted for inflation, have gone down. In addition, they've given $100 million in concessions over this period. So there has been a sense of, I think, BART workers of being responsible during tough times. Their concern going forward is they're well aware of the precariousness of what the system faces, but they're also aware that BART is making an operating profit today. They maintain that it will have a surplus over the next decade. They want to regain some of what they lost. They want an equitable deal going forward. I think that's something that most Americans could sympathize with. And as we were speaking before, much earlier, decades ago, the notion of union gains lifting everyone else was paramount. Today, there is a broad feeling that union gains come at the expense of everyone else, and I think that's misguided.
Some more comments from listeners on Facebook. Will writes, the only substantial change that will save BART is to remove the greedy union. There are plenty of people willing and able in the workforce that would love the expired pay rates. Unions were useful when there were no worker rights, but now that workers are protected by workforce laws, unions are now simply extortionists. And Jeff responds, Will, you're wrong. Unions may need reform, but they are critical for worker and public protections. Big business making record profits while middle-class wages stagnate. It's not the workers who are greedy extortionists. Let me bring another caller on here, and this is a caller. Karma, good morning.
Hi there. Before my comment, though, I actually want to address the previous comment where the person said that the union's not working with other unions and is setting a bad example for unions. Actually, I read in an alternate article yesterday that the union scheduled this particular strike to support other public sector workers that were also going on strike but didn't have as high-profile jobs. So I just thought that was interesting. But all the talk that I'm hearing is about wages, wages, wages. But everything that I've actually seen from the union says that this strike is about safety. And, I mean, there was a guy who died last year because of the lighting in the BART tunnels, and they have a lot of issues with the TSA locking the bathrooms and people peeing and pooing in the actual trains. So I would just like that to be addressed more often and for less of the focus to be on wages, since that doesn't seem to be a huge part of what their complaint is about. And second, just in a general sense, talking about the whole, you know, PR issue, most of the people I've been talking to are complaining about the inconvenience and wishing they would just fire all these workers and replace them. Well, I am somebody who rides BART. It's been incredibly inconvenient to me, but guess what? A strike is supposed to be inconvenient. It's supposed to show people that this is, that the workers have power, that they actually do something of import in society, and that we should value that, and that if they stop doing that thing, that it will inconvenience us. But beyond that, people need to think about the bigger picture. You can't say, oh, I don't like this strike. I'm not against unions in general, but this union is corrupt, and I want the government to intervene, because that sets a precedent that will affect all unions in future strikes.
All right, Karma, thank you for those comments. And I want to go back to Phil Wilson, because, Phil Wilson, you were talking earlier about really the obstacles to going on strike and the legal difficulties. And here we have a listener named Max who says, please talk about how the Taft-Hartley Act makes solidarity strikes illegal, making it much harder for labor to do large-scale organizing because general strikes are impossible.
Well, a couple things. First, I think on Carmen's point, yeah, I think it's interesting, and this kind of leaps back to what Harley was saying about the PR part of this campaign. I mean, the unions are definitely taking it on the chin right now, which you would expect because it is inconveniencing a lot of people's lives. And Carmen makes the exact right point that, you know, that's the whole point. You know, that's part of the leverage that they're playing. I think, you know, a couple other points on that, though. The idea that this is driven by safety and not wages is, I would bet, you know, anything I had on that. If BART went in at 1 o'clock this afternoon and said, okay, well, we've decided that we'll agree to 20% wage increase, you don't have to pay anything for your pension, you don't have to pay any more for your health care, but we're not going to do any of these safety things that you're asking about, the contract would be settled in 10 minutes. So the safety issues are what the two unions have to have on the table to sort of make this not just about wages.
So you're saying they're cosmetic mainly?
I wouldn't go so far as to say they're cosmetic. I'm sure that if they had their druthers, they would have, you know, they would get BART to agree to everything.
I mean, there are real safety concerns. I talked to the union people, and they're legitimate.
Yeah. There are, but I'm just saying that, you know, at the end of the day, what's important here is the money. And then I think, I think the commenter makes a good point that, you know, one of the things that is different about U.S. labor law than laws in other countries is that you don't have so much of the sort of mass strike activity where everything is everything gets shut down. Like you see a lot of times in Europe and sometimes even in Latin American countries. But
I think Taft-Hartley has made it more and more difficult, I think we can
say. The flip side of that is, though, I think if you look at things like Occupy and if you look at things like the Fight for 15 activity, there's still ways to leverage communities that don't violate the labor laws. And so I think that, I think it's true, it's probably more difficult to do that sort of activity in the United States, but I don't think it's impossible, certainly. And and I think we're seeing unions take more advantage of those opportunities.
Let me bring on another caller here. And Sue, that's you. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning. I just want to offer maybe a slightly different perspective. I'm 56, and I'm from the Bay Area. I'm a white-collar worker. I have a master's degree, and I come from a household that was not particularly fond of unions, but in my own experience has really changed my views here, and it seems to me that what's really going on in this country is a very concerted move to pit worker against worker. And what's happened with me is I've been a contract worker for the last 7 years. I haven't had a single paid day off, not Christmas, not New Year, not 4th of July. I have no health care benefits. I have no sick days off. I have no 401k. And people say, well, you're paid more to compensate for that. I'm not, because the recruiting firms take about 50% of what I would be making if I was working directly, and most of the large corporations will no longer hire you without you coming through a recruiting firm. So I just think that really the unions are missing a great opportunity to try to engage white-collar workers. I've had a number of discussions with a neighbor and actually with the security guard who was working at Wells Fargo, which was my last contract, and where I understand, my understanding is that about 50% of the current people working for Wells Fargo are working on contract with no benefits at all, I mean, in the whole country. I'd like to, I don't know if that's true, but I've heard that from a source I trust. And I've looked at people who are just standing at the protesters, staring at them on California Street, and I've walked up to them and said, do you have health benefits? And they say, oh, yeah. I say, do you get paid days off, vacation? They say, yeah. And they're looking at me as a white-collar manager, and I'm saying, you know what? I have none of that, and you really shouldn't be staring at those people and sneering at them. You should be out marching with them.
All right. I thank you for those comments. We appreciate them. A listener on Facebook says he's disappointed the forum only has pro-union guests on, too. Phil Wilson is not pro-union. just, I guess, shows how fair-minded you can sound, Phil. This is supposed to be news, not agenda pushing, writes this gentleman, Will, on Facebook. And let's clarify that. No agenda is being pushed here. However, this may sound like an agenda to some, Harley Shaken, but the fact of the matter is I was just looking at Harper's Index last night, which I enjoy reading, and the figure, for example, the number of Americans who have been hired, let's say by Apple, is pathetic. I mean, you know, it's in the low low 300-something or 400-something like that. You know, outsourcing has to be figured into what we're talking about here and what is hurting the union movement and organized labor. Jobs are easy to simply ship overseas and have been.
Outsourcing is very surely a problem that labor faces, but that's mostly in the manufacturing sector. There has been outsourcing, of course, in programming and other areas that are growing, but where it had the most devastating initial impact on unions was, in fact, in manufacturing. But I think there's a broader set of issues here that Phil alluded to a bit earlier. It is very difficult to form a union in this country. You really risk companies that skirt the law or even violate the law, because it's very difficult to have meaningful penalties given the current circumstances. Unions face challenges globally, but in Canada, very similar in many ways to the U.S. economy, union density, that is the percentage of workers in unions, is 28%. In Germany, it's 20%. That's the most competitive exporting economy in the world today. In the U.S., it's a little over 11%. And I think one of the factors that's different here is how difficult it is to form a union. And more broadly speaking, union leaders now, as we were speaking earlier, are well aware that it's a crisis. Some, like Rich Trumka, in fact, many union leaders have sought to portray unions as seeking to represent workers more generally and social justice across a wide swath of the economy. That means their position on immigration really stems out of that, not just self-interest or economic interest, more narrowly speaking. So you've got unions seeking to play that broader role, but it's within a climate where there's a lot of pushback and where the challenges are very real.
And Phil Wilson, let me get you on the record here. I mean, you really, I'll be frank about this, you don't believe unions do much for workers, do you?
Not really. I think that, you know, the evidence sort of speaks for itself. If unions did deliver what they promise, and you know, you can make the argument that it's because of you know, management doesn't want unions to get in, and I'd like to respond to something that Harley said a second ago, but you know, or you can say that it's structural, and the economy is in such a state that unions just can't deliver. But I mean, at the end of the day, if unions actually did create these great gains for working people, you know, union halls would look like, you know, Walmart on the day after Thanksgiving, right? People would be banging down the doors to get in. And the fact is, it's just not true. Now, you know, and the reason why people get upset at situations like BART is because they see folks that have a much better deal than virtually anybody else, that are, and look, rightfully so, they're doing everything that they can to keep that deal in place, and the unions are doing their job by doing everything that they can to try to keep that deal in place. But it's very hard for, you know, the average worker in America to kind of see that deal and say, you know, more power to you. That, you know, they think that they should be happy with that deal and move on. And you know, unions, frankly, are not getting that deal, you know, very often. They're you know, and because of that, you know, they're just not, you know, they just don't, they're selling a product that just isn't that attractive. And that I think is their bigger challenge, as opposed to, you know, a lot of times they'll complain that they can't organize because of the, you know, because of the law and employers that skirt the law. And you know, frankly, my whole career is based on helping educate people during these organizing events. And the bottom line is that you do not have to skirt the law. You do not have to fire people. You do not have to even get close to the boundary lines to win an organizing election, because the facts just pretty much speak for themselves. People just don't know that much about unions today. That's just the reality. They're just not that, you know, common. People haven't been in them that, you know we're decades away from when, you know, a third of our population was in a union, and you would run into people all the time that were in one even if you weren't. And because of that, when you get into an organizing event, the organizers who are selling the union, you know, they kind of make their pitch and it sounds pretty good, but then when confronted with the realities of what unions actually deliver, most people say, you know, that doesn't really seem like such a great deal, and it certainly doesn't seem like something I want to pay a lot of money for.
Again, Phil Wilson is a labor lawyer and president of the Labor Relations Institute. They are a management-side labor relations consulting firm, and our next caller joining us is Craig. Good morning, Craig.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, basically, the labor law in this country is in shambles. You know, Mr. Wilson talked about how people are protected by the NLRB, but actually the wait time, if you get fired from a place because you're involved in a union drive, the wait time is something like 965 days. So basically the strategy by management is just to delay, delay, delay. And this wait time, you know, people basically forget that there's a union drive going on in the place. You know, we live in a country where there's very little labor protection for most people. Also, just cause, you know, the only people who have just cause are people who are in unions. So people are afraid, in some sense, to form a union. There's an interesting book that came out last year called Why Labor Organizing Should Be a Civil Right. And it details what, you know, how this process takes place and the 960-day delay that basically, you know, obliterates labor law for most people.
Let me, Craig, get a response from Phil Wilson on this. Those delays in the NLRB are pretty accurate in terms of the way they've been stated, are they not, Phil Wilson?
I don't know if the number of days is right, but it's definitely true that, like I said earlier, it's glacially slow. And I guess my reply, so the caller is exactly right. If an employee is terminated, and the allegation is made that was because of organizing activity, it takes a long time for those cases to get resolved. The flip side of that, on the employer side, I mean, we see this constantly, is that if a group of employees are involved in an organizing effort and it becomes, you know, clear to the organizers that the union is not going to win that election, they can do exactly the same thing. They can put that delay in their favor, so they can file a charge right before a vote, and then that case also can take years to resolve. And I mean, literally, I've seen cases that last 5 years and longer. The longest I've seen lasted 12 years. And those are cases that those employees are in limbo for that entire time. They lose the franchise. They never get an opportunity to vote. There's actually a case in California, and this is under the Farm, the Agricultural Labor Act, but where a group of employees had a vote 23 years ago, and the union just showed up late last year to start trying to bargain an agreement that they never were involved in prior to that point. The employees that are currently there now, you know, weren't not only were they not employed there, many of them were not even born when the union was organized. And I think that is that's a fundamental problem with labor law. If justice is not swift, and look, that means that employers will have decisions like terminations decided much faster, whether that's for or against them. But the same thing is true. Unions will have these objections to elections and conduct that delays whether a group of employees get to have their vote. All of that should be decided much, much faster.
Let me get Harley Shaken on this. Harley Shaken?
Well, I think there's a real core contradiction to what Phil was saying here. On one level, he's saying that people are resentment, say, of BART workers because unions have gotten them so much. And then the flip side of what he's saying is people won't join unions because they can't deliver. Both simply can't be true. I think what we're seeing is workers not joining unions very often because it's hazardous to their economic life if they do, meaning they'll get fired or they'll be disciplined in other ways, and the law isn't in place to protect them. But it really, to take a broader view for a moment, I think in any democratic society, unions play an essential role. President Obama several days ago spoke to the president of Egypt with all the turmoil there. He told him a democracy is more than fair elections. Unions provide checks and balances for any democratic society.
We'll leave it there. It has been a very, I think, enlightening discussion. I want to extend thanks to Phil Wilson, who again is with the Labor Relations Institute, and Harley Shaken, University of California, Berkeley professor who specializes in labor issues. And you, our listeners, we wouldn't be here without you. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Our thanks go out to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.